Accession number 17117, Reel 5.
Mr. Coco, Reel 5.
We found, of course, that with all the tables set out as they were, that there was no front. This was, in fact, reality. When the menu appeared before us, we had a choice of menu. This lunch, we had lunch there to kick off with. And bearing in mind our goat's meat and rice, or sheep and rice and the arum pura, this indeed was heaven. And believe me, I've never known, and I've never forgotten this time. And we had a cabin between four in the cabin, and that was it. We lived, it was just like a cruise. She was a coal burner, and we then set sail for Durban, and we had a mainly army on the thing, who were coming back from the Far East, from Middle East as well, from Iraq and Basra, and some RAF from Basra. But we then set sail for Durban, and we arrived quite safely. It was a beautiful cruise. When we got to Durban, we went ashore then into Clarewood Camp, and we lived under canvas. That, now, after the Empress of Russia, was a bit of a shock. But nevertheless, we were well fed. South Africa, of course, is self-sufficient in the matter of food, and there was no problem on this. And the fact that we lived under canvas was no great hardship, because the weather was good, and we're looking at the period of time when we are talking of now in January of 1942. And of course, we're talking of their summer period, when, of course, the sun is warm and that sort of thing. We were in Clarewood Camp. I suppose it must be now for about a fortnight, 3 weeks, wondering what is going to happen with us. We were meeting up with all kinds of survivors coming down as well from the Mediterranean, because Clarewood Camp was quite a big camp, as I said, on the canvas, but it was a gathering and a transit area for, and I met survivors there from the Barham and from other ships sunk in the Mediterranean, and we were all waiting transit back home. The unknown to us, the Empress of Russia, had remained in Durban undergoing some repairs, and after about, as I said, our period in Clarewood, it would be about a fortnight to 3 weeks, no more than 3 weeks. We were then draft, our little group of ordnance artificers and ERAs and EAs, we were then drafted aboard, back aboard the Empress of Russia for the final trip back to the UK. It was at that point that we found that two of the engineers, these are the Merchant Navy engineers from the Empress of Russia, had jumped ship, as it were, in South Africa. And that's not surprising, bearing in mind that it's rather, paradise, as it were. They jumped ship, and two of our engine room people from the Prince of Wales, in fact, signed articles to be engineers in the Empress of Russia. And they said, well, of course, here is nothing to do but wander around the upper deck. We might as well earn some money on the way home. And they became fourth class engineers or whatever it was. They did their watch keeping, and they were paid under Merchant Navy rates of pay, and they were very, very happy. And they lived in the engineers' mess aboard the Empress of Russia. But life aboard that was just a cruise. And so it continued. We stopped at Cape Town. Then off we went back. And the only time we got a little worried was as we were approaching, we were crossing Biscay, and we received news that the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau and I think the Eugen had escaped from Brest, and it was not known in which direction they were going. And I can remember everyone was thinking and grubbing round with all the last pennies they had, and we raided the bar and we all tended to get ourselves a little bit drunk that night, think to ourselves, oh dear, we've come so far, but it now so seems as if, you know, we're going to be thwarted at the last moment. But fortunately for us, next morning it came to light that these three had turned up the channel, and of course history well knows and records what happened there. So we carried on our steam and into Liverpool, and I can remember coming into Liverpool about in late March, it would be beginning April, about 1942. I then went from there. Oh, by the way, I ought really to mention that in Colombo I did pick up a bit of kit. I picked up a cap, and I think I picked up a pair of trousers and a jacket, but that was about all. There were no shirts going, because there was a great demand on the stores there. They not expected this. So this is about all I arrived back in UK. And I can remember getting on the train in Liverpool, and still the three of us carrying our little pillowcase, and we arrived at Denport station and arrived in Denport barracks looking very, very forlorn. And for a change, they did take quite some sympathy on us and kitted us out. And I can remember going off on then 14 days survivor's leave. I have 14 days survivor's leave, at the end of which I came back into Denport barracks. And I spent, I suppose, then about a fortnight in Denport barracks and down in the workshop of OAs and EAs. Some of my contemporaries who were ERAs and had engine room watchkeeping certificates, they lasted during the war, and this became quite the norm during the war. ERAs with a watchkeeping certificate, no matter how many times they'd been sunk, they could come into barracks and they would last about 1 week before they'd go to another one. And that's how that's how it was on technical people. I lasted, as I said there, it was about a fortnight, and I got a J number. I can't remember what it was, a J something like 340 or something, to which you say, what is J340 at the drafting office? And they say, well, we don't know exactly what it is, but it is building, just finishing off on the Clyde. And I can remember two of us, one OA, Billy Webb, who he was in Y Turret in the Prince of Wales. He was the same, a petty officer, same as myself then. And we went then to Glasgow to the ship. And one of the things which sticks in my mind is that, because I come from Plymouth, my mother saw me off at the station and with my wife, and I can remember a certain amount of feeling almost embarrassed, in so much as they'd come to see me off almost like a public schoolboy being seen off by mum, please don't kiss me, sort of thing. And but having said that, you know, I look back on this with a degree of regret now in my maturity, in so much as that I am with my peers. There are about, I suppose, 20 of us in the draft and about 6 in our carriage. And, you know, it was entirely silly of me when I look back on it, because there was my own mother. You know, it is the people who are left behind. And in many ways, because you're young and you accept the war, in so much that you know it's something you've got to do, you never think, of course, that you're going to get killed. In no way at all can you believe that. There's always going to be someone else. But your own mother and your own wife just doesn't share that kind of confidence, or misplaced confidence it might be, that you might have. And they have to do the waiting. They have to do the awaiting for the knock on the door, that telegram which arrives to say that the Admiralty regrets, that sort of thing. And so it was on that station. That's one of the things I've never forgotten, that I should really have shown them rather more affection when I left, because it was just a wave of, oh, cheerio, then see you, and off I went. And we went then, arrived in Glasgow. We lived in Diggs again for about a fortnight, whilst the Bramham was being completed. The Bramham, by the way, is a Hunt-class destroyer. I think she was about 980 tons. And Billy Webb, the laddie I mentioned just earlier, just recently there, the other OA survivor from the Prince of Wales, he went to the Meteor, a bigger M-class destroyer, which was just completing in the same yard. When we completed, off we went on trials, and then it came and dawned on me, because in many ways, when people said to me about next ships and where you're going to go, I had said, well, I would rather go to a small ship and go to a destroyer than go to another ship like the Prince of Wales. I didn't want any more of this bugle blowing and all this tannoy sounding stuff. And when I went out for the first trials in the Prince of Wales, in the down in the Clyde, off what is known as Paddy's Hump, that is Aylsa Craig, and the Swordfish carried out their first dummy attack on us, I realised how small that ship was, and that here the thing was just 28 foot beam, and that you could almost with a hop, skip and a jump go from one side of the ship to the other, and you felt suddenly very, very vulnerable. And here then you started to come up with another kind of reality. But having said that, they were a closer knit bunch in that ship. Nothing like the Prince of Wales, where you've got something like 1,600 people in the crew, where, of course, it's a long time before you get to know anyone. And there are people in ships like the Prince of Wales who probably never get to know anyone anyway during a whole 2 years' commission. But in the Bramham, it was a small ship, and we were very soon blooded. After our workup, our trials, we... one of the first things we did, notable things, apart from doing a few sweeps out into the Atlantic and off Scapa Flow, it's always rough, we went off down to Jib, and apart from a little adventure down there with a submarine, I can remember hunting around for this thing around the Azores, but we arrived in Jib alongside another destroyer, which as far as I can remember, was one of the F-class destroyer. It might have been the Fury or Foresight. But they quite blandly told us, oh, we're gathering here for a club run. And apparently the club run was a convoy to Malta. And I think 2 days after that, we set off on Operation Pedestal. And I take you, want me to go off?
Please, if you go through right the details of that.
No, Pedestal occurred in August of 42, and all things seemed to happen during the war to me at about the time of my birthday, in about August, as I mentioned earlier, Roosevelt giving me that, well, inverted commas, that great gift on my birthday in Placentia Bay. This convoy took place again on my birthday, and we started out on August the 9th. We always gathered in Jib at the time of no moon, because over on the La Linea side from Gibraltar, I can't imagine what they look like. I can't imagine a shower of Germans or Nazis sitting there with binoculars glued to their eyes. But nevertheless, they did keep a very close eye on us gathering and all the shipping in Gibraltar. But the fact is, it was announced in the papers that here there could well be another convoy because Axis reports. And we set off on this night of no moon, and we left Jib and we slipped, and off we went into the darkness of the night. And it wasn't, of course, until next morning at first light that we saw that we were with the convoy. And the convoy composed of 14 ships, 14 ships which were quite fast on merchant navy terms. I mean, you're talking here of fast being of 14 or 15 knots, of good quality ships too, of refrigerated ships, of tankers and that sort of thing. All had been carrying loads which had been spread so that some would carry an amount of ammunition as well as supplies, so that in the event of any being sunk, supplies or ammunition would get through. Anyway, our disposition in the convoy, being a Hunt-class destroyer, we had no torpedoes in this. We carried 6 twin 4-inch guns. Our disposition in the convoy was close anti-aircraft escort. So we were right in next to the merchant ships. And that was the way, of course, the whole convoy processed. But it wasn't long. We hadn't been proceeding, almost sounds a policeman to say that, but we hadn't been going long before, just at late forenoon, if I remember, there was the action stations, and then of course a big bang, and that was when the Eagle was torpedoed. This was some distance from the other side of the convoy, but it was quite clear, you could see this thing, and it was in fact a portent of things to come. And the I can't remember precisely, I think it might have been the Ithuriel, one of the I boats, which in fact rammed the destroyer, which had in fact had sunk the Eagle. Anyway, that was one of our carriers gone, and it was quite clear that from that moment on, that was quite early in the convoy, it was quite clear that as we approached the dangerous part of the Mediterranean, we got nearer to Malta, that we were going to be in for a fair old dusting off, as it were. The next day we had an air attack, the next morning, I remember that, and it came over quite determined, but there were rather more high level bombers, and the anti-aircraft fire which was put up was, well, the expression is and the cliche is that the flak was so thick that you could walk on it, and that just about seems to be about it, that no great inroads were made on the convoy at all and no damage was done. But then the next one after that was rather more determined, and this is now probably the next day as we're getting into Malta, and things really started to hot now, and we were attacked now continuously. The attacks started now to beat up one after the other, and in one of the attacks, the Deucalion, one of the ships, merchant ships near us, had a near miss, and as a result of this, she went down by the bows a bit, and instead of steaming at about 14, 15 knots, she had to ease back at about 10, and the crew were thinking at first that she was going to be abandoned, but they stayed aboard, or went back aboard, and we were detailed off because our captain was Lieutenant Baines. Our first lieutenant was the Marquess of Milford Haven, whose uncle was the Earl Mountbatten. But we were detailed off as being a junior ship, as it were, with just merely a lieutenant as a captain, to escort the Deucalion as best we may towards Malta, and the convoy went on. We then took her as near as we could to the North African coast with the object of trying to get inside the 3-mile limit, and steaming along there is a kind of neutral, and then making a rush for it. But the convoy, which was on the horizon by now, was getting tons of stick from the bombing, and those that couldn't get through to the main part of the convoy came and took it out of us. And eventually, of course, the Deucalion was hit again and stopped completely. She was caught on fire. We circled this thing around and around. We tried firing depth charges at it in order to sink it. We'd taken the crew off. Obviously, the crew had been taken aboard us. We'd taken the crew off. But we'd circled around it, firing depth charge at it, because we had no torpedoes, of course, being a Hunt. And that had no effect. And eventually, she slowly settled, and she did sink. Now, of course, we left with the Deucalion's crew to join the convoy, and we got back to the convoy, and when we got back, this would be, as my recollection, on, I think, the Wednesday night. We'd set off from Gib, I think, on the Sunday. This would be on the Wednesday night, and by now, hells are popping in every sense of the word. And we had, now the carriers had turned back, because this is as far as they would go, and we were left with the small ships to go through the narrows. So this was when, of course, the Axis forces threw their utmost at us in the way of E-boats and torpedo bombers and all sorts of things. Anyway, now it is dark, and quite frankly, under the weight of the attack, we split up and the convoy scattered, and we just wandered aimlessly, dare I say. And I can remember that night, it was a matter of very strained eyes from every lookout. There was tracer were coming up sporadically around on the horizon. We did not see a lot ourselves. I can remember seeing this great dark shape of Pantelleria, or Pantelleria, as the BBC might call it, which of course was manned by the Italians. And I can remember the sub-lieutenant, Mitchell, when being asked by the captain, "Where are we?" He just didn't know. And I can remember this quite plainly, because I used to take an action station to the back of the bridge, because there's only one of me in the ship, and I then could make myself available. But I can remember these things as plainly as anything. We went around this great big hump of a rock and just steamed, almost tiptoed as it were, around, absolutely alone, and then we had the news that the Italian fleet had come out. And oh dear, the Italian fleet had come out. Of course, history now shows that Mussolini had, and by subterfuge, had ordered them back again. We didn't know that. But we knew that they were out. And on about our third circumnavigation of Pantelleria, out of the darkness of the night came this great big set of bows towards us. And I can remember our yeoman of signals, looking like the rest of us on the bridge, saying, in what we thought was a terribly loud voice, "Shall I challenge them?" And the captain had almost wearily said, "Yes, righto, yeoman." And the yeoman challenging this great big set of bows, and there was no answer. And the yeoman again, in too loud a voice, saying, "Challenge again, sir." And the captain say, "Well, I suppose we must." And we challenged, and still no answer. And then from the ADP, that's the director behind me, then the Lieutenant Rule saying there, "Load, sir." "Yes, righto, Rule." So we loaded, and I can remember the breech is, you know, snapping shut on a gun, and hearing them back aft as well. And we were, the idea was that we'd give this thing a broadside and get the hell out of it. But just as we were about all loaded, out of the darkness came this pale blue light, and we had our answer. And it turned out to be the Dorset, one of the merchant ships. And she was as lost as we were. So we said, "Jolly good and nice to see you," you know, is the sort of comment that one would make, you know, "Dr. Livingston, I believe," or whatever. And we then turned and steamed then eastwards towards Malta. As light came, then we started to see the others, and we started to catch up with the others. And of course, as we caught up with the others, so did the bombing start again. They caught up with us. And one of the tankers was hit, the name of which escapes me for the moment. There was a great plume of smoke went right up high in the sky. You could see it for miles and miles around. And for hours afterwards, after we'd left, we went then to assist on this, but Ledbury had taken over there, because one of the ploys, of course, in this, when you're trying to rescue from a tanker, is that with oil on the water, you rig fire main, that's the fire main hoses, and you play these from the forecastle to play the oil back along the surface of the water as it's on fire, to make a kind of lane in towards any survivors who might be there. And we did that, but we then left that and left Ledbury to it. We then joined up with the rest, and we were then with the Manchester. That was duly hit in the course of time, and of course we have all this in the now the history of this thing. But at the end of the day, I'm afraid life was getting rather hectic, and we ended up with the Dorset as well was hit, and we tried to tow this thing, but she's a massive great merchant ship, and we were a little 980 tons, and there was no way we could do that, and it was left, I think, entirely on her own. There was another one we had to try at, and then eventually we caught up with the Ohio, and we found ourselves then detailed off to take over with the Penn the towing of the Ohio. And we tried towing it from forward. That didn't work, and then our captain then suggested that with Penn on one side, and if we were on the other side, we were on the port side, that if we joined forces that way, we might manage to make some headway. And this is something we did. And I must say that here, again, this tended to, when I look back on this, I can remember, you know, when I think of the war, and as I mentioned before, about the Prince of Wales and the bugles blowing, and the kind of status consciousness in the show. In the Bremen, it was totally different. You had a job to do, and people wore shorts and football jerseys. For food, we had two great big above the boiler room, which in fact didn't help particularly. We had to move it, but it was a central part of the ship. We had two tea chests, partly filled, one with biscuits and the other with, they put layers around the wood, of course, the tea chest, but just cut up corned beef and just put the corned beef in there, and you, if you wanted something to eat, you just took a biscuit and some corned beef. But when we got alongside the Ohio, by jingo, we again had hit the jackpot, because the Ohio was well equipped with all kinds of stores, like grapefruit, tins of peaches and this sort of thing, things we hadn't seen for ages. And it was very much a matter of, well, she's in a bad state, we don't know if we shall meet Malta, reach Malta rather, and so the lads were going aboard, and they were helping, and we lived quite well for that moment. We towed this thing. If the convoy had gone according